Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
I'm John Zipperer, the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial, and your host for this program. On today's program, we will look at political strategist Karl Rove's recent comments about how to game the 2016 presidential election, the effort to draft alternatives to Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side. The New York Times recently replaced its first female executive editor, and we'll look at what that means, if anything, for women in high levels of the journalism profession. Plus, we'll look at our surprisingly colorful race for governor here in California, even though that conclusion is, well, all but preordained. So, as always, we will try to provide some insight into these topics, and any opinions expressed are those solely of the speakers and not necessarily of the Commonwealth Club. So let's meet our panelists for today. I'm going to start on the end of the stage over there with Carla Marinucci, the senior political writer at the San Francisco Chronicle. She's on Twitter at @cmarinucci. Next to her is Dr. Larry Gersten, political science professor at San Jose State University, also a political analyst at NBC Bay Area, and the author of numerous books, but most recently, Not So Golden After All, The Rise and Fall of California. And he's on Twitter at @lgersten. And next to me is Bill Whalen, research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. You can find his writing on the Hoover blog, Advancing a Free Society, as well as various newspapers in the state. He's on Twitter at Hoover Whalen. So please use the question cards that are spread throughout the room to write down and submit your questions. I will try to ask as many as possible during today's program. Now on to our roundtable. I wanted to start with Karl Rove re-entering the national debate. The New York Post reported last week that Republican strategist Karl Rove suggested that Hillary Clinton might have suffered brain damage as a result of a fall she took a couple years ago. He relied on the highly scientific reasoning that she was photographed wearing dark glasses as she left the hospital. So there was a lot of political back and forth, as you would expect, as the Clintonites and Democrats and even some Republicans condemned Rove's remarks. But Rove has turned the whole issue into a referendum of, can we make a health issue of a candidate a legitimate issue? And that is kind of where the conversation has gone since then. Carla, do you think Rove's initial comment, was that just an off-the-cuff thing, or do you think he was actually consciously trying to plant this as a
topic? Oh, no. I think Bush's brain absolutely plans every comment, and I think this one shows that Bush's brain needs to have his head examined, Bill Whalen. That's what I mean, look, Hillary Clinton at this point is not just the 800-pound gorilla. She's the King Kong ready to go up, you know, scale the Empire State Building, and Karl Rove is there already trying to throw the net over her. It shows they're quaking at looking at Hillary. And I have to say, Republicans didn't like to hear this talk either. You heard all the Sunday shows this weekend. Look, do we really have to go there? There are so many issues. And I got to say, too, they got to watch where they're going with women voters when they start trying this far in advance to knock Hillary Clinton down on age issues, because let's see, how much longer do we live than men? I just want to point that out. 70 is a new 50, okay? So go for it, Karl Rove, but I think it was a mistake.
Well, and no less of a Clinton antagonist than Newt Gingrich was an early condemner, person to condemn this. Bill, what did you make of this?
Yeah, moot court rebuttal. I make of this that Karl Rove is a very clever man who likes to throw marbles in front of people's direction. And what he is getting at is not so much the issue of Hillary Clinton's brain power or her health. He is trying to get to the issue of a word seldom used with the Clintons, which is the word forthcoming. Bill Clinton promptly went out and defended his wife. And in the great tradition that Bill Clinton started in 2008, where he would say something about his wife, which would invariably cause a separate story, which would be a problem for his wife, he said that not only was Hillary indeed, you know, her health issues legitimate, it took her 6 months to get over this, which begs the question, 6 months, my God, what was wrong with you? 6 months. The point with Rove is I think he's trying to draw the Clintons into this sort of bruising, tiresome, back and forth, he said, she said, Republicans versus Democrats combat that's been going on ever since the Clintons first ran for national office. Mm-hmm. And look at it this way. If it is a Clinton-Bush race, if it's Hillary Clinton versus Jeb Bush in 2016, it's a referendum not just on those two people running for office, but on those two last names and the state of politics in the last quarter of a century. So I think in a roundabout way, Rove is actually very cleverly trying to draw the Clintons into this rancorous discussion that a lot of people are probably getting tired of.
Larry, was this a good way to get them distracted on this issue?
I think it's a one news cycle story, right. And I think we saw that by the way that almost everybody reacted to it. Some just shrugged their shoulders, some rolled their eyes, some said he shouldn't have said it. I heard, I don't know who I, if anyone I heard say, he's right on point. I think health and I think age are both legitimate issues to raise anytime. It's kind of funny, some Democrats I know got really upset about the age thing. Well, weren't people saying that about Ronald Reagan? It's legitimate. Let's face it. When people, as we get older, these things become legitimate issues.
Yeah.
And there's no particular age when someone starts to, lose some of his or her sharpness. So, I think that's fine. The way he raised it, mm-hmm. it sort of undermined his own claims. I think he hurt himself that way.
And I think I got to say, Hillary Clinton has spoke here in San Francisco a couple of times now. We just covered her recently. I mean, the woman was on stage tackling all kinds of questions before thousands of people, from Ukraine to, tech to jobs in the economy. If she's got some issue there, boy, she hides it so well. And they're watching this. I think Jerry Brown made a good point over the weekend in one of the shows saying, if you're on the pedestal, this is a dangerous place to be this far out. Mm-hmm. And you have to wonder, she's doing so many appearances and so many speaking engagements, she's almost throwing it out there for them.
I think the smart Republican strategy is, again, not to claim that Hillary Clinton is tired come 2016, but to suggest that the Clintons, plural, are tiring to the public, and that do you really want another 8 years of the Clintons and the assorted complications that go on, because nothing is ever forthcoming. Everything depends on the definition of what is. So I think that's the smarter ploy for the Republicans moving forward.
Well, they better hope that their nominee isn't Bush then.
Right.
Because the same thing will be thrown right back at them, And I don't think it's fair in either case, but people do that stuff.
Is this a good example of trying to get out well ahead of the curve and define your opponent, raise these issues, remind people of these things so that, like you're saying, not only do the Clintons kind of follow those arguments and fights, but that the voters are thinking of that candidate in those terms, the same way Obama was kind of credited or blamed with defining Romney or George Herbert Walker Bush with defining Dukakis early on,
yeah.
So that they spend half their time just trying to undefine themselves rather than talk about what they would want.
But you got to have some substance with that.
Right.
You can't just throw out a bomb, and have it land by itself. You better have other ones behind it. There has to be something to support what you're saying. Otherwise, you look like what Rove looks like right now, at least. I think Rove's a really smart guy. But on this issue, he looks pretty silly.
Do you think it'll sway a single vote, this or Benghazi?
No. I think Hillary Clinton's a very polarizing figure, and I think there's just a very hard-set faction that will not vote for her and a very hard-set faction that will vote for her, and probably a very small sliver in between that's going to have to make up its mind between now and 2016.
Yeah. Speaking of polarizing figures, a question from the audience. Do you think Sarah Palin will run for Senate from Alaska? Will this be a win, in quotes, for American women?
I'd sure love to see it. I think that's already decided, at least this time around. The dates are closed for the nominations in Alaska. So she's not running. And why should she? She'd take a terrible pay cut.
and I think she loves what she's doing which is not having to answer substantive media questions, but just mouthing off whenever she wants to.
Yeah, and there's one other factor, which is she likes to be the star. She likes to be the center of attention.
Sure.
And you go to the United States Senate, and the fact is that you are a backbencher. It's a question, by the way, that faces someone like Gavin Newsom here in California or Kamala Harris, who are very attractive people who are serving in the executive branch. Do you want to go to Washington and be a very small player in the Washington process? And there's no way Palin wants to do that.
Okay. Well, let's stick with or return to Hillary, if you will. She was The last time she was the so-called inevitable Democratic presidential candidate, her candidacy, of course, was derailed. The anti-war part of the party really swung over to Senator Barack Obama when he entered the race and, of course, went on to win. Now, even though she's still an undeclared candidate, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, there are longings among the party's sizable left for an alternative, perhaps an Elizabeth Warren. Bill, I mean, are these, is this just kind of the anybody but Clinton sort of scrambling, or is it just because she hasn't yet totally announced and taken charge of the
Hasn't totally announced, and so by playing cat and mouse, what you do is you freeze the financial field. You're a serious Democratic donor. Do you want to invest in an alternative to Hillary, not knowing what she's going to do? So that speaks to why she is not going to run sooner rather than later. She needs competition in the primaries. Competition makes you sharper. Maybe doesn't make her lose the nomination, but it keeps her on her toes.
Yeah.
And it's like a sparring partner, if you will. So the question is, who will get in the race? Elizabeth Warren is the name that has been bandied about of late. The person who I keep my eye on is Deval Patrick, the governor of Massachusetts.
And why him?
Why him? Because he is very Obama-centric in a lot of ways, including the fact that David Axelrod, Obama's consultant, is his consultant. And you would think that maybe the Obama people would like to have a rather pro-Obama figure in the primaries, figuring that whoever the nominee is going to be is going to have to at some point distance himself from the president and maybe be a little disparaging in the presidency. And also, not to filibuster here, but you can run a very good campaign against Hillary, not attack her, be positive and upbeat, say nice things about her, but tout yourself. And in case she loses in 2016, there you are in position in 2020.
And Deval Patrick sort of threw out the first pitch on that one this weekend by saying the inevitability factor is something that Democrats are concerned about. And that is the one concern I hear when you talk to people in Silicon Valley even. Many of them supported Barack Obama. They watched that Hillary campaign go down, and they are hoping that this time around she brings in some new, fresh people to get across the finish line. That's what the concern is. And I think you're already seeing her out here sort of making those moves. And she has people like Jennifer Granholm working on the Ready for Hillary pack already.
Yes.
So she's got some very vibrant people behind her. Elizabeth Warren, a lot of progressive Democrats would love to see her run. And she's coming out with a book this year, which is usually a campaign move. But on the other hand, from what we understand, the book doesn't go into any of the issues that are typical in a presidential year kind of book. She has said no a million times. So I don't think that's
going to happen. When asked if she thinks Hillary Clinton should be the president, would be a good president, she does the one thing that drives reporters crazy and starts all the speculation. She doesn't say, yes, I think Hillary would be a great president. She says, I think Hillary's swell. That's just leaving the door wide open to this kind of speculation.
Hillary's likable enough. Didn't we hear that
likeable
once?
Enough.
Didn't we hear that once from Obama? You know, I think you make a really good point about how anybody running should have some competition. I mean, for a lot of reasons. You need some debates. You need to sharpen your game. On your point, Carla, her staff is much different now than it was in 08. I mean, she's cleaned house and brought in an entirely new wave of people for campaigning. Campaigning now is so different than it was 8 years ago.
And a lot of the folks who worked on President Obama's reelection have moved over into her campaign.
Shifted over. But there's no question about it that things happen to people. You know, I mean, again, she's, what, 68, 69 years old. Things can happen. So you've got the Warrens, you've got Martin O'Malley, you've got Patrick, you've got Joe Biden. You know, you've got people out there, all of who are capable of running a race if they have to. And I think they're all trying to sort of like stay alive, at least on the periphery, just in case.
Well, it took us about 5 minutes of talking about the Democratic lineup for 2016 before we brought up the vice president, who you would think would normally be the front runner. He recently made a speech that was sort of for the meat and potatoes, income inequality crowd. Is he going for the Elizabeth Warren imaginary candidacy, that constituency?
He's part of that group.
Right. Yeah.
He's part of that group. I mean, if Hillary Clinton runs, the only point is Bill's point. I mean, you know, there's got to be somebody out there to spar with her, you know, and I don't think any of those people who think Biden, of course, this is his last chance, if any. But the others, you know, they're looking downstream.
Sure.
So they can't get out there and spar if they're serious about it because they have to wait their turn. But somebody has to. Yeah, no question.
I think, I mean, many of you may have seen Mayor Castro of San Antonio here at the Commonwealth Club His brother also, the congressman, came and sat in the front row. He's an amazing speaker. He did a great job at the Democratic Convention. He is very sharp. And the Housing and Urban Development Cabinet position that he's been offered, I guess they're vetting him for it now. But a lot of people are looking ahead saying this is a brilliant move. A Texan, a state that looks like it's about to flip or in maybe the next 4 to 8 years, you're preparing the ground. He's 42. He's got plenty of time, but that I think that move was really interesting to watch in terms of offering him that post.
2024.
Seriously.
Yeah.
2024.
Versus George P. Bush.
Yeah. Yeah. It could be. Could be by then. Yeah.
And Chelsea Clinton. Bring it on.
Bill, you wrote about this, in fact.
I did.
This morning.
Julian Castro, he's 39 going on 40. He'll be 42 in 2016. You're Hillary Clinton in 2016. You turned 69 years old in October of that month. And you have to appeal to who to get elected? The same coalition that worked for Obama, which is a combination of women. Remember, Obama benefited from the largest gender gap in presidential history. You have to benefit from minorities, so she has to find some way to bump out the African-American turnout like Obama did twice. She has to benefit from a large surge among Hispanic voters and also a large surge from young Gen X and millennial voters. A 69-year-old candidate has a fundamental problem connecting to younger voters, and she also has a bit of a challenge appealing to minority voters based on the fact that, unlike Barack Obama, she doesn't have the same compelling story to tell. Enter someone like Julian Castro, who can appeal on age. If you go back, I encourage you to go on YouTube and look at his speech. He gave the keynote at the 2012 Democratic National Convention. It is an appeal straight to young voters. And if he were on the ticket, he'd be a natural balance in terms of reaching out to Hispanic voters, and then secondly, those young voters who Hillary sorely needs. So now, this is speculation on the border of out of control, because we don't know if Hillary's going to run, and it's probably premature to speculate on who would be the ticket with Hillary, but it's interesting, because historically, HUD is not a upward trajectory contract. My father worked at HUD for 20 years as a budget office. He can tell you that it's a rather sleepy backwater in a lot of ways in terms of Washington. So if you're a rising politician, you don't want to go to HUD necessarily. But for Julian Castro, who's been a mayor of San Antonio, getting a couple years of Washington under his belt makes him a very attractive possibility for 2016.
Why did Ronald Reagan, why was he able to have, because he actually did connect with young voters and get them excited and really gave the Republicans an advantage among young voters for quite a while. Was he the anomaly, or was it a time when what he was politically selling was particularly of interest to them? What was his magic?
My magic would be that he benefited from running against two rather sad sack opponents, Jimmy Carter and Michael Walter Mondale, yeah. Number one. And there's been a problem for Republicans ever since Reagan, the so-called Alex P. Keaton voters, it was called. Remember, Michael J. Fox on the TV show Family Ties was this obnoxious little Ronald Reagan supporter named Alex P. Keaton. And so this was a guy who, remember in the show, he has a little baby son, and he puts a badge of, takes a campaign button of Nixon and puts it on and says, believe. This was the kind of young person who Reagan brought into the Republican fold, but Republicans have been searching for that same youth thing ever since. Remember George H.W. Bush, father of 43. He runs in 1988, and his campaign has the brilliant idea of putting a 41-year-old senator on the ticket to appeal to the youth vote. Dan Quayle. Didn't quite work out, did it? Sarah Palin was supposed to in some way jazz younger voters because she was kind of hip and interesting and outdoorsy. Didn't quite work. So we're forever, you know, in search of El Dorado here, trying to find our little fountain of youth.
Yeah, and I think this gets to the point about VP candidates can only do so much.
Right.
I mean, I certainly think that if the Democrats are wise, they'll come up with a Latino candidate for VP. Who, I don't know. But you know, we know that historically, vice presidential candidates don't carry it. They just don't. Oh, he'll take the state because it's a perfect combination and we'll swing over Florida or Texas or whatever. No, you know, these guys are people who may make it downstream, but they're holding places for in many ways. Mm-hmm. They don't really do much.
And when you talk about millennial voters and exciting them, I think it's ultimately about the issues: income inequality, their unemployment rate, the libertarian on social issues. Whether that's going to be a fit with any of some the Republican candidates that are offered, that's going to be the question, I think.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about Republican candidates. Larry, you've in the past here said, you know, a Jeb Bush Hillary Clinton matchup would be a very solid matchup.
I love it. I just love it. I just do, because they're both of substance. They're both of substance. You know, I mean, you know, these people know what they're talking about. You know, Jeb Bush is one smart cookie. Yeah. I think he runs circles around it, the rest of them. And Hillary Clinton, enough, we've said enough about her already. His problem is the perennial problem, you know, that Republicans have, because they got all these wackos on the far right who whack each other to see how far right each can get, you know, and you know, someone like him, you know, moderates like Romney find themselves brought into that whole maelstrom. Bush has to say, stay away from it and say, you guys fight. I'm here. When you're ready for the big boy in the room, I'm here.
And he has already been staking out positions that are not Tea Party friendly.
That's the way he has to do it. Yeah. That's the way he has to do it. And there's a risk there. There's a real risk because we know who votes for the Republicans in Iowa and New Hampshire and all these places. You know, they're not the moderates. Maybe New Hampshire he gets some independence. But it's tough. But I think Bush runs a great race, and he carries Florida right off the bat, and he's got Texas. I mean, you know, you're talking about, you know, the two biggest states after California. And this becomes, you know, I know I'm not making a lot of friends here, but this becomes, there's a lot of you between me and the door. This becomes a real good foundation for the Republican Party after a two-term incumbent that the public's tired of.
So one problem. He is a great 270 candidate for Republicans. The idea of getting 270 electoral votes win the White House, just as the man whose space he currently occupies, Chris Christie, was saying it's the same thing. Chris Christie could win in a blue state. He could get 270 electoral votes. The problem here is these guys, look at that frowny face over there. Chris Christie and Jeb Bush have to get through a Republican primary process,
yes, right.
A bruising Republican primary process. Dominated by conservatives, social conservatives in particular.
Right.
And in 2016, a field that, unlike past Republican campaigns, where there's a front runner nominally, financially, organizationally, it's wide open. It's a bunch of peers. It's a bunch of men in their 40s and 50s, most of whom have not run for this before, and nobody will enter the race with a decided advantage, somebody whose race it is to lose. So it's a real interesting contradiction to see. On the one hand, the Republicans are trying to contract the primary process. They're trying to do this quicker. They want to have their national convention earlier. At the same time, they have a lot of candidates who overlap with each other, and, you know, I'm not sure how the process is going to sort itself out.
I still wonder, too, about the, you know, if Hillary's going to have problems with this, the Bush fatigue issue. I mean, if Condi Rice couldn't speak at a commencement speech recently because of all the Iraq war business, what's Jeb Bush going to face?
I wouldn't use the college student. A former president of UC Berkeley was not allowed to speak.
That's true. But I'm wondering how much of that is going to be resurrected. I think we still have to watch Rand Paul, who just spoke at Berkeley recently. I saw him and interviewed him there. He turned out so many students to see him. He got a huge reception. He's been very, very smart in the way he's appealed to these young voters. So I think we still have to watch where he goes.
And you know what else he did recently that I found so intriguing? He got on Republicans for trying to suppress the vote.
Right.
Smart move. Yes. So the courts are going to knock down these guys anyway, you know, so get ahead of it. You know, a smart move on his part.
There's only one problem with the Bush-Clinton matchup.
The main
one that I can see, you'll have to medicate Maureen Dowd. Who has made a living for the past quarter of a century psychoanalyzing the Clintons and the Bushes. Her head just may explode if the two of them are running at the same time.
What I tend to think of is in these days when campaigning is so hideously expensive, so much relies on the get out the vote, these built-in networks of having the enthusiastic supporters. There already is a Clinton network. There already is a Bush network.
Right.
That both touch all the big donors and all the right donors, know how the system works. Just as it's probably Hillary's nomination to lose, is it Jeb Bush's nomination to lose, or does he have a much harder time getting through that primary?
He has a much harder time.
Yeah.
He has a much, no comparison. I mean, you know, it's hers if she wants it. We know that. But him, no, he's got to fight off these guys in a primary and caucus system that is stacked against somebody like Bush.
Right.
But you know, the question is, you know, have Republicans finally hit themselves in the head enough times, you know, or do they have to do it again? You know, how many times do you have to bang your head against the wall before you realize it's not going to work? Especially as their numbers are dwindling.
Yes. Are you suggesting that Republicans are brain damaged?
I'll let you say it. Okay, well, let's look at a bit of a different topic. Last week, I think you've probably all seen this story. It got quite a bit of play, not just in the New York Times, but the New York Times, the Gray Lady, as it's called, ousted Jill Abramson, the paper's first female executive editor. Now, this generated lots of talk about representation by women in the top levels of journalism, whether she had different expectations of her than, say, a man would or had in that position, how she was treated, all of that kind of stuff. I'm going to put you on the spot, Carla. what do you make of this? Is it reflective of anything wider than her relationship with her boss and her employees?
No, I mean, I think this story dramatized the changes in the news business. Like when I first got into this business, I got my first job, I was told, "Well, you can't cover news. We don't have any women doing it. Would you like to write about weddings and society?" That's how I got into the news business. That was my only door into the newsroom. That's changed, but you know, we still have a very few women running newspapers. I have to say, my paper is one of them. As president and the managing editor are both women, mm-hmm. but that's rare. And I think this story brought up, and fired up by the income inequality issue, I think that took it to another level. Or there's sort of a debate about whether that really was an issue.
You're referring to whether or not
she was paid as much as her predecessor. But I think a lot of women related to that. A lot of women in the newsroom. I mean, we know it has been a long haul for women trying to. When I first started covering politics, I was many times the only woman in the room, and I think Jill Abramson has taken a lot of shots for being a very tough boss and a bossy boss and somebody who doesn't get along. I mean, how many guys have we all had to work with have had like these kind of qualities, and yet they continue on? But the fact is, I think it's unclear. The reason that this story matters so much to so many people who is in an audience like this, especially you guys are informed, you care about the news, is because the New York Times is seen as America's paper, and we're all watching the changes that are going on there, and they're reflective of the trauma that every newspaper, including my own, is going through and trying to work with the digital age and to change how news is delivered. So I think the jury's out on the total picture of why this change was made. Maybe it was that she just wasn't a right fit for the newsroom, and maybe they recognized that. But the fact is that there were clearly other issues, and she was a pioneer, and I think that matters to a lot of people in the business.
There's a story.
Go ahead, Larry.
I believe it's this morning's New York Times. This is the advantage of coming up on the train. The columnist, I don't remember.
David Carr, I read it.
It's a good story, where he talked about apparently her management style was such that she particularly offended Batten, is his name, I think. Is that Banquet?
Beckett.
Who was sort of next in command when she was bringing this other person from, I forget what newspaper magazine it was,
The Guardian.
Yeah, to be his equal,
right.
And that offended him, and he threatened to quit. He threatened to leave, and so now they're stuck with a bad situation. Who do I get rid of? Because they both can't be in this room. I agree. This is a complex story. It's got many, many layers, and sometimes we just want to throw a simple solution. It's because of this. It's because of that. But I do share your opinion. I think there's a whole thing with gender here that we just tend to ignore. And if a woman is in a room and she's making things happen, she's pushy. And if a guy's in a room, he's assertive. Well, you know, I mean, we're not used to seeing that many women in those positions of authority. And so because of that, you know, we brand them differently than we brand males. And I think that's a culture thing. I think it's for real.
Someone in the audience wrote along those lines, men can be mean girls, women cannot. Bill, we were talking before this program. There's other issues here as far as her interactions with the company, her interactions with her boss.
Right.
Tell us a bit about that.
Politico ran a really devastating story on her about a year ago, which got into her management style, her relationship or lack thereof with Pinch Salzberger, who's the Salzbergers in the publishing family that owns the New York Times. After that story, she was apparently quite wounded by it. She went out and hired a consultant coach to work on her person skills. So this is not new. I think it's as simple as this. And I think there's an analogy here, and that's look across the bay to the Golden State Warriors. The Golden State Warriors had a very good season by most standards. They won their most games, I think, in 20 years. They went to the first round of the playoffs. They were undermanned. They got to the last game in their series. The players played their heart out for their coach, who they loved very much. And what did management do? They fired their coach, Mark Jackson, the day after the playoffs. And why did they fire him? They didn't fire him because he was black, because he is black and he was replaced by a white male. They fired him because he did not get along with the ownership. And we can speculate about gender, and maybe gender plays a role here, and it's all complicated because of contracts and confidentiality clauses. We don't know this story. It's he said, she said, and proxies from the two sides saying their sides of the stories. But it could be just as simple as that she and Sulzberger had an awful relationship over the course of time, and as has been reported and been talked about, she, in investigating her salary situation, whether or not she was getting underpaid, she actually hired a lawyer. And perhaps by hiring a lawyer to investigate into this, that was a tipping point. He decided enough. I think on another level, it's an interesting window into the New York Times itself, in that Sulzberger made ultimately a business decision, and he decided that Jill Abramson, who is historic and has actually been a pretty successful editor in terms of Pulitzer Prizes and pushing the paper in the digital age, he decided that she was replaceable and replaceable overnight. Keep in mind that they didn't just toss her overboard. They didn't have any kind of ceremony where she handed off the baton, and they took her name off the masthead as soon as they could. So it was, to me, just a very, very personal takedown of her.
Yeah.
Someone asks, Melissa Mayer, the CEO of, is she CEO or president?
CEO
of Yahoo, is not setting the world on fire at Yahoo. Why? There's a lot of pressure when you're the first woman to head one of these organizations to either super exceed, or if you don't succeed, all this focus is why.
That's right. And, you know, and I think these stories sort of dramatize the numbers are still so small. Only 3% of CEOs in this country are women. And I think all of us would like to see that grow, and we're seeing some of the pressures. You know, Marissa Mayer took a lot of criticism on issues of working at home, changes she made at Yahoo. And I think we've heard a lot from Sheryl Sandberg about leaning in, and you know, every woman in the audience who's read it, you know, I've had lots of conversations with women on this. Is it realistic? How many of us can really lean in on the job, or do we have to kind of figure out more? You know, what are the paths to success?
Yeah.
Because and I think all of these stories dramatize the dilemma for women as they move up the chain.
Was it 1970 or 71 when female employees of Newsweek won a large, kind of a landmark discrimination case against the magazine, alleging they had been relegated to, if not reporting on weddings, basically providing support for the men who were the reporters and the editors, and that started changing after that. Obviously, they actually won their case against Newsweek.
Yeah, that was a landmark case for women in the media, and that's about the same time I was getting into the news business. So, I mean, I relate to this a lot. The first city council meeting I ever covered, the city manager asked me to get coffee for him. I mean, you know, I mean, this is like, so I get it all. I mean, we all get it, all of us who have done this here. Right. But as Bill said, I think there are, in this case, there may be other issues that relate to running the newsroom, which is like complicated, and the challenges these days in terms of trying to figure out the digital side of it. Yeah. So please sign on to my Twitter account. It's C. Mayer.
What other lesson here?
These challenges are huge, and we're not. You know, we don't know where we're going on it.
Right. The other lesson here: Jill Abramson likes sports tattoos. On her back, she has a tattoo of the Gothic New York Times T. So I think the takeaway here is never get your company's name tattooed on
your body. I agree.
That's the Johnny Depp rule.
Do you have a Chronicle tattoo?
No, absolutely not.
Well, let's look at some more 2014 election stuff, but closer to home here in California. There are some Republicans running to try to become the next governor. As our frequent panelist Deborah J. Saunders says, they're basically running for the opportunity to lose to Governor Brown. But this has become quite interesting. We have conservative Republican Tim Donnelly, who is keeping up his reputation for being very outspoken, not afraid to ruffle feathers, This does not seem to worry him. Donnelly says he's more interested in how conservatives feel about him than how the Republican Party feels about him. And Carla, you recently, I guess you folks had him in for
that's right.
An editorial.
On the other side of the fence, we had Friday, we had Jerry Brown in for the editorial board at the Chronicle. And when you watch him, he comes in, he sits down, he's got like 12 editors and reporters, all of them wanting to beat him up. No notes, nothing, doesn't have any entourage. And you can just level anything at him, and he's just willing to debate you. And he's quoting Hobbes and, Cicero and, it's like crazy.
As one does, yes.
Yeah, and he's just confident, and he gets, it's just a show. It's a show. And on the other hand, last week we had a debate between the Republican candidates at a shock jock radio station.
Yeah.
These are two guys who want to run the eighth largest economy. To listen to this debate on the radio, they had an effigy of Jerry Brown in the studio. They invited the live audience to come up and, rub him with massage oil. It was like...
We're not going to do that here.
You promised.
It was a frat house debate. And I said to I wrote a blog about it saying, do not the voters of California deserve better than this from two guys who say they want to run the state? If the Republicans on the other side are not taken seriously, it's because it's their own fault, as far as I'm concerned.
That sounds like it was the equivalent. I don't know if you've seen the video of the Idaho gubernatorial debate. If not, Google it. Watch it on YouTube.
Yeah.
It'll be the best 5 minutes you've spent this week. it's something. Bill, so there's Tim Donnelly. The other leading candidate on the Republican side is Neil Kashkari. What does the Republican Party itself make of these two candidates?
This is what bottom looks like. You have a backbenching assemblyman who his colleagues can't get rid of fast enough in Sacramento running against Neil Kashkari, who was the Bush administration's point man on TARP. Not a very popular idea in Republican circles. Voted for Barack Obama in 2008. And is a very earnest young man, and he's putting a lot of shoe leather into his campaign, but the fact is he probably should be running down ticket. Back in 2002, Bill Simon, who ended up being the Republican gubernatorial nominee, wanted to run for state treasurer. And he went to Sacramento, and he sat down with a consultant, and the consultant sized up his candidacy and came to one conclusion, payday. And he talked Simon into running for governor. And this is unfortunately the curse on both parties' sides, by the way. Ambitious people don't want to run down the ticket. They all want to be a governor. They all don't want to be a senator. They don't want to bother with the constitutional offices, and they don't want to get the training, which is sorely needed here. Mm-hmm. But what you're seeing playing out in California is what you see playing out in other pockets of America with Republicans, and there's all times of the debate between grassroots Tea Party Republicans and more mainstream establishment Republicans.
Right.
And you can swap out Neil Kashkari and Tim Donnelly for Mr. Bevin and Mr. McConnell in Kentucky and primaries in Georgia and Nebraska and elsewhere around the country, and it ties ultimately into 2016 and more Republican soul-searching. But at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter because whoever that nominee is, they're not going to even get close to Jerry in the general election.
I quibble with you on a little bit. I think it does matter. I think it matters in two ways. I think it matters in terms of the next few years for the Republican Party.
Yeah, I wish I could. It does matter in terms of Republican turnout.
The party is already 29%, and that's counting some people twice. it's not good. It's just if you believe in two-party politics, and I do, it's not good to have a party, scrambling like the Republican Party is right now. So I think it's a tipping point in that respect. And I think the other reason why this is an important race, to me, it's one of my favorites, is because the governorship is up for grabs in 2018. And who's going to
after Brown or the Attorney General?
Yeah, I'm seeding that. Okay. So at that point, you got a clean slate here, and you don't have the baggage of incumbency to worry about. You've got a much better shot. The money comes out, mm-hmm. Which of course Kashkari's not been getting a lot of for reasons we've talked about before. Even his backers think he's going to lose. But does this not position whoever comes out ahead here as a more serious candidate for 2018? And that's why I think this fight is really important. I do it. I don't think Republicans have a very strong bench for 2018, which is why I think the future of the party right now will tell us a whole lot.
I just got to wonder how different is this from this parade of Republican candidates we've seen before, because here Neel Kashkari, you're right, very smart guy, but here's a guy who said he was not going to self-fund his campaign, and now he's put $2 million of his own money into his campaign, of which he says his entire net worth is $5 million. Don't you have to wonder, how wise is somebody putting almost half of their net worth into this kind of a race? What kind of ambition or ego or whatever is involved in that? And I think the other issue is, you're right, Larry, he's never run for anything before, not dog catcher. We looked up his voting record. It's not even that good. So can you really make the case? After this, said, done it once, so I put $2 million, or maybe more now he's going to put in.
He's like a five-year-old right now, learning how to ride a bicycle with training wheels. No, I mean that very seriously, okay? And by golly, 4 years from now, the nine-year-old, doesn't need any training wheels. You know, he knows how to ride a bike. I wouldn't have chosen this route for him,
right.
But he didn't ask me. but this is the route he's taken. Whether it's hubris, whatever, I don't know, okay? But the point simply is that money will do well for him. It buys him name recognition. It gets his evolving brand out there. And 4 years from now, people aren't going to be saying, Neel Kashkari? They're going to know who he is. And I don't, we're all looking ahead, because this race seems so decided already. But I just think, it's his investment. I think it's his investment.
It is, I think, going to be interesting to see Tim Donnelly, who we've interviewed many times. He was also in the Chronicle last week.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to watch him, because here is a guy who, his issues, are some of them are crazy. He wants a gun in every California home, the Sharia law, et cetera. But on the other hand, as an interview, he's very entertaining. He's a guy who says he's driving around California in a car with 370,000 miles on it. I mean, basically hitting every shock jock radio station and every Republican, meeting there is. And he really riles them up. I saw him here in San Francisco at the Republican meeting. He got a full house, and they gave him a standing ovation, and by the time he was finished. That kind of work, you can throw commercials out there all you want, but those are the voters that go to the polls, and they're voting early. You can all vote early right now. And he's banking on getting those super, involved, passionate conservative voters.
And in a low turnout election, that just may work.
Right.
Which
is why Kashkari has to put his money in to spend, because he has to bump the turnout in his direction by doing mailers, by running ads to get more less interested Republicans to bother to turn out. And spending half of his own fortune on this, it's $2 to $3 million. We'd all like to have $2 to $3 million to blow on something. But, Meg Whitman spent $80 million in the primary in 2010, so actually 2 to 3 is pretty small by California standards. I would also say that the fact that he's willing to spend his own money, what if he wasn't spending his own money? Wouldn't that kind of raise a question, too? How serious are you running? I mean, look at Tim Draper's initiative right now, the Six Californians initiative. How much? Yeah, headache. Speaking of heads exploding. How much money is Tim putting into his effort? He could put $10 or $20 million in it to get a pass, but he's being very selective with his money. So that, there's a flip side to not spending your own money, which is it raises the question of how serious you are. But, we'll see. The greatest guess here is nobody knows who's going to turn out on primary day here in California. The guess is it's, about a 27% turnout or something like that, and we don't know what the walk-up vote's going to be.
But 50% of those voters are already voting by mail, and that's where...
Oh, more than that.
More than that, right?
More than half already vote by mail.
Probably
70% this time.
Yeah.
But don't forget... There are blocks out there besides those really rabid right-wing Donnelly supporters, okay? And I admit, they're out there. But there's 22% of the states declined to state, or no political parties, as we now call it. There can be a lot of Democrats out there who, I don't need to worry about Jerry Brown. I'm going to help decide this Republican thing one way or the other. I think there's more fluidity out there than we'd like to think. The only poll we have is one that was taken 6 or 8 weeks ago when, even Mrs. Kashkari didn't know Neel was running. I mean, her son.
And I kind of wonder. here too. You get a good point. I mean, what Donnelly said to us, and he tried to make the case that this whole race sort of exposes a divide between the country club Republicans and kind of the country, the real Republicans, you know, the average folk Republicans. Donnelly said to us, you know, I'm going to put a little more country in their country club. And he's right in the sense of who is coming out to support Kashkari. It's the Condoleezza Rices. It's the, you know, Karl Roves. It's the same people who supported Meg Whitman, you know, Mitt Romney, et cetera. And maybe his argument is those people have lost touch with the average Republican voter in California.
Well, and what I think also, talking like Larry's idea of the Neil Kashkari playing the long game, he's playing for the next election. Tim Donnelly and people on his side, they are going to be working for their views over the next 4 years, even when they're not running. Will Neil Kashkari be struggling for the soul of his party in the same way, or will he just be looking for when is the next filing deadline for running for himself?
Well, you're right. I mean, you know, we were talking about throwing one bomb and then walking away. He can't be doing that.
Right.
If he's serious, you know, even if he loses the nomination, that yeah, there's a story out of that. You know, yeah. If he loses the nomination, it's not the end of his world either.
Right.
Because he'll say, see, it didn't work. Okay? So, I mean, he's got many opportunities here. And what he has to do is go get a nice job paying him $750,000 a year at a bond company of some sort, like a PIMCO or wherever he was. Which is where he was, and you know, make back that $2 million in about whatever a nanosecond, and then go out there and start do the stump thing, the Rotary clubs, the this, the that, you know, get it out there and keep that criticism against the crazy train, as he calls it, and I think that the guy stands a pretty good position then.
And there's a history. I worked for Pete Wilson in a past life. Mm-hmm. Pete Wilson was elected to the Senate in 1982, in part because he was lucky enough to run against Jerry Brown in 1982, and Californians were tired of Jerry after 8 years as governor. But Wilson also benefited from the fact that in 1978, he ran in the Republican primary for governor, and mm-hmm. I think he finished third or fourth. He likes to joke that his campaign was a haven for people who feared large crowds. but he got around the state and he met people and he developed a little name recognition. So by the time 1982 came around, mm-hmm. he was more of a known entity outside of San Diego where he was the mayor. So that's the path of Kashkari. And you look at the Republican depth problem. You have members of Congress who in theory could run, but they're never going to give up a day job because they're in the majority and they're in power and life is good.
Right.
The availability of wealthy millionaires who might be willing to run, I would suggest that's been seriously compromised by what Meg Whitman went through, where she spent not only $160 million, but was thoroughly dragged through the mud. I don't think anybody of wealth wants to do that. So you need to find people who are willing to go through this process at least once or twice or three times to break through. And that means just a lot of, you know, running and being willing to lose, but in the process, developing some street cred, developing name recognition, and being ready the next time the job comes open.
Yeah.
Well, let's get to some questions from the audience. The name Tim Draper came up earlier. Does he have political ambitions, or would, say, a gubernatorial run be a step down from being a venture capitalist?
I don't know him. You may know him. I bet you know him. Mm-hmm. I don't know him, but I think he's somebody who wants to sort of, like, manipulate things from the outside. I mean, manipulate in a bad way, by the way. I mean, you know, to try to influence.
Yes.
Influence goings-on, you know, whether it's people running for office or issues. And we've got people like that, you know. And Stiers on the other side of that.
Right.
And I think these people do us a good service. I mean, even if they'd come up with things that I think are kind of questionable, as
the six
Californians. I mean, you know, it's questionable for a lot of reasons, not the least of which you need the approval of if everybody voted for it, not going to happen. You need the approval of Congress. And can you imagine two U.S. senators and now them going along with 12? From California when they're trying to get rid of the two we got? No.
How many San Franciscans want to live in a state called Silicon Valley?
Thank you.
Not too many hands. No, Tim is Tim has political interest. He ran a school choice initiative back in 2000, I believe it was, that was slaughtered. He is now doing the Six Californians Initiative. He is a former Republican who became a Democrat, has now given that up. He has declined to state. It's hard to see him running for governor simply because he hates the political system, which is why he is doing the Six Californias. So it would require some serious rhetorical jiu-jitsu to go from wanting to explode the state to now suddenly I want to bring it together and run it. So
Okay.
Yeah.
We were talking about the potential Jeb Bush candidacy. Someone writes in, Barbara Bush said in public that Jeb should not run, that we've had enough Bushes. And what I really wanted to take that into was Jeb Bush's own immediate family has expressed views, or at least has been reported to have expressed views, that they're not particularly thrilled about this option of him running. Do we know anything more about what that works into the calculus for him, or do you
the
think
Barbara
the party
Bush
might
thing,
lean
of
on
course,
him?
Happened at least 6 months ago,
yeah.
And
she's
since recanted that.
Right.
You know, it was just a
they
weak
had an intervention.
So I don't think that's an issue anymore. I mean, yeah, I think, you know, when you run for an office like this, this is serious business. You know, your life is turned inside out.
Yeah.
Why anyone would do it, I'll never know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's awful. You don't have a life, and you better get the family's buy-in. Interesting thing though, let's remember he has a Mexican born wife,
mm-hmm.
and when you're talking about appealing to now the largest minority in the country,
mm-hmm.
that is yet another plus for him, assuming he could even get by these primaries.
Or she could run as Hillary Clinton's running mate.
I think she's actually, I think, more the stumbling block than the mother is, because it's kind of the Alma Powell scenario,
yeah,
where
yeah.
Colin
yeah.
Powell looked at the presidency and his wife was dead set against it. So you figure that Mrs. Bush has to weigh in all the calculations of her running, including the fact that she will be used for better and for worse, given her ethnicity.
The immigrant problem.
Yeah.
The immigrant problem now in Washington. Mm-hmm. Oh, boy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that is one topic he has been speaking out against, the
right.
some of the Republicans.
Right.
Well, let's go to another one. This is a long question, but it's got an interesting story in it, so I want to share it. A couple of years ago, my wife and I visited Turkey, Crimea, and Kiev. And on the streets of Kiev, they ran into Bill Clinton. Quote, Bill Clinton, what in the hell are you doing here raising money, they asked. Yeah, he said. So, well, a Hillary campaign, the point being he was raising money for his foundation. And the foundation is going to get a lot of attention in this next election. Do you think, how much, will that be a problem? Will that be a, let's get it out of the way now, and this goes right to the disclosure issue
yeah,
you were talking
yeah, no.
about, doesn't it, Bill?
The New York Times did a long piece about the Clinton Foundation about a year ago, and shortly after that, Chelsea Clinton sort of took over the foundation, and I think her job is to kind of oversee the foundation, and I think in a very kind of kind, benign way, keep her father on a very short leash.
Mm-hmm.
Her father is at all times moving in all directions. He's doing Clinton Foundation work, and he's doing business deals, and he's doing politics and all that. And it's always a question of what company he keeps. And so I think his daughter is going to be sort of the guard of that, if you will.
I think Bill's right. I mean, the look at the Clinton Foundation, we've already seen some investigative stories on it. We'll see more. This will be yet another place where the media will focus on Hillary. On the other hand, Bill Clinton, with that stage of the Clinton Foundation, has just taken his message all over the world, and they've done some very good things also. And it does allow Chelsea, once again, reaching out to those millennial voters. So I think it's a plus. I think the Clinton Foundation issue is a plus for them, but you're right, Bill, with some of the looks already at some of the finances of it, there's a danger that maybe there's some more there to be uncovered.
And just so people who haven't followed that story kind of know more about it, the criticisms about the foundation have been, was it where the money was coming from or how it was being spent or both?
I think it was both. It was both. But I think, like the Gates Foundation, the Clinton Foundation has just done some pretty amazing things in the developing world.
Mm-hmm.
And he's gotten a lot of praise for that. And I don't know.
And raised a lot of money.
Raised a lot of money, yes. And Bill Clinton out there is gold for her.
You know,
whatever stage.
If you don't like Hillary Clinton, the Clinton Global Initiative is going to be just another reason why you don't want to like her, right? Going out there and spending money in places where it should be instead of spending it here. I mean, think of all the arguments, right? And raising it from who knows what. You know, and if you do, you're going to say, you see, this is one more example of her or the family's public regarding this. So I think you're right. I think, and unless you find some sort of scandal, you know, always possible.
I'm not sure.
You know, unless you find some sort of scandal, I think it's a plus.
I don't see where he is necessarily a plus for her running for president.
Well, if he keeps his mouth closed, he'll be.
Seriously, figure it this way. She has had experience now in three national campaigns, two of his and one of hers. I'm not sure what more she can teach him to the extent that she has to be taught how to run for president. Second, as we saw in 2008, he has a knack of getting off message. Remember, in 2008, only black people are going to vote for Obama. His campaign's a joke. He's not qualified to be president. The kind of stuff that a campaign spends 24 to 48 hours digging out of.
Yeah, but remember that speech he gave to the Democratic Convention?
Yeah, which was for Barack Obama, not his wife.
Yeah,
he's wonderful.
Yeah,
he's wonderful helping other people, but not his wife.
When he is on, he is unmatchable.
Charismatic, beyond belief.
Charismatic, but then conversely, he gets up the other day and he says that Hillary was sick for 6 months.
Yeah.
Well,
he
causes little fires.
You know, the question is, you know, I believe she has learned an awful lot from that 2008 run. Mm-hmm. And I think he has too. He's always going to, on some level, put his foot in his mouth because that's who he is. That's why you put your hand to your head in grief, and that's why you smile. I mean, you know, he's that kind of person.
Right.
But I think you know they're gonna run a really good campaign.
I just think the toughest job in America will be her campaign manager in 2016.
Oh, God.
Because there'll be 50 people who all think that they're her best friend, and she should take their advice.
That is the danger.
And you're gonna have to at some point tell the big dog that he can't go on TV and he's got to stay on message and control yourself. And it's very hard for a campaign manager to do, as we saw in 2008.
They'll send him back to Ukraine.
There are, of course, other campaigns going on. And we were talking a bit about this before in terms of some of the primaries in Tennessee and such. Someone asked, what incumbent is most in danger of being knocked out in the June open primary? Obviously, in California, there's the open primary. But across the country, there are some very interesting primaries. In particular, I think on the Republican side, where the expected Tea Party challenges in many cases have fizzled out. Bill?
Probably Thad Cochran in Mississippi, because most Republican primaries, either the Republican is going to survive or it's an open race, one or the other. But Cochran in Mississippi is under pressure for a couple of reasons. One, he's just been around for a long time. Second, there's an ugly personal story going around. His wife has been hospitalized and, I guess, institutionalized. He has been involved with another woman right now. Maybe there's going to be a backlash against this, and the Tea Party will benefit. But you are not so far seeing the circular firing squad that you saw in 2010 and 2012 that cost Republicans at least 5 Senate seats around the country. North Carolina showed this last week. So the Republicans have that going. But I don't see too much carnage.
Well, in California, if you're looking at the primary, I think you've got to look at the race with Ami Bera up in Sacramento. He's definitely endangered. We'll see what happens.
But he's in trouble for November, not June.
Yeah, for November.
Same thing
right.
with Peters in San Diego.
And then, of course, locally we have the race with Honda and Ro Khanna. And
that's
then I think Tom McClintock is facing a challenge from his own party.
Yeah. A moderate Republican.
He doesn't live in his district, and he's getting
50 miles
heat.
Away. It's stone's throw. What an arm.
One last question before we go to our news quiz. The question is, was the issue of age and health a question raised about John McCain during the 2008?
Yes.
Absolutely.
It was certainly raised.
Yes.
Do you think it played a role in...
Not only was his age and health raised, but the fact that he was in a North Vietnamese camp for 6.5 years. And how does anybody come out of that the way they went in? Yeah, I don't care who you are. Mm-hmm. I mean, so that was the question raised as well. But let's remember, I mean, you know... You can mention all those three things. The worst of all things to happen wasn't any of those things. It was McCain in September of that year when the economy plunged. The stock market went down 500 points. And he comes out and he says, don't worry, the economy's in fine shape. What?
Yeah.
Okay, that's what did it more than anything else.
Yeah.
Yeah. But age and health, you're right. Bob Dole, remember, fell down. Wasn't it?
Fell off the stage.
I remember covering that, and it became... the issue in that campaign that sort of cemented the he's too old to be president kind of line.
Of course, if we use that, I've been too old since I was born. I fall down all the time.
Okay, well, let's do our news quiz. Could I have one of our helpers come forward? We've got some nice Ghirardelli chocolates for people who can answer some news quiz questions. I'm going to read a question. If you think you know the answer... raise your hand. I'll call on you and shout out the answer. If you're correct, you'll win one of our prizes. If not, There's food out there on the library and some wine to help solve your hurt. So let's start with the first question. The biggest Democratic election in the world, in history, if I'm correct, just took place in what country? And I saw your hand. I'm sorry?
India.
That's correct. India. You are our first winner today. Now, who won that election? What? Yes, sir.
Modi.
Sorry?
Modi.
Correct. Do you know the name of the... he won in the suit back there. Do you know the name of his party? You've already won. This is just for fun. No. Right, it was the Bharatiya Janata Party. Yeah, the Congress Party lost in a landslide, you could say. Next question. What will Google and other search engines be forced to do in Europe after losing a case there? Ma'am.
Remove information that people want to get off the internet, even if it's true or not.
That's correct. Remove old information, links to information that infringe upon people's so-called, quote, right to be forgotten, unquote. Next question. Name the country where a woman was sentenced to death for apostasy and adultery because she was Christian and the state does not recognize her marriage.
Sudan,
that is correct.
Mm. Yeah. Got a hot crowd here today.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Very good.
Should go right to the tough questions, huh? What did Swiss voters defeat at the polls this weekend by a 3-1 margin? And sir, right back there, I saw you first. Sorry? That's correct. They do not currently have a minimum wage. They were voting on instituting the equivalent of $25 an hour minimum wage. It would almost be enough to live in San Francisco. Okay. This might be a bit more difficult. A historian in Germany uncovered evidence that Nazi veterans did what after World War II? Did anyone see this story?
I don't know.
Go ahead. No. Not bad. Anyone want to make a guess beyond cricket? Okay, I'll just tell you. They created a secret reserve army in case the country was invaded from the east, I guess.
Wow.
And it apparently went on for a number of years until they created the Bundeswehr. Okay, African leaders have banded together to fight what? Sir? Boko Haram, yes. Go ahead. That's the group that has been kidnapping girls and attacking schools and churches and not nice people. Okay. A prankster hacked into a digital traffic sign in San Francisco's Van Ness Avenue last week to warn drivers about what, ma'am?
The city is too hot. The city is closed.
No, actually.
No.
Sorry. Back there.
Wow.
That's right. Godzilla. The message...
I'm sorry, too, but they had that.
Did they really?
Yes, they did.
Okay. Let's give her a prize. in the pink top there.
City's too hot.
And do we have any left?
I haven't seen. Does he take out the Godzilla? Does he take out the Google buses and Godzilla?
The sign actually said Godzilla attack, turn back.
Takes out the Golden Gate Bridge, however.
Okay. Next question. Anti-Chinese protests led China to evacuate thousands of Chinese from what country, sir?
Vietnam,
that's correct. And for our final question, what does MERS, M-E-R-S, stand for? That's correct. Folks, thank you very much.
This audience is great.
Deliver you another prize.
Thank you.
We'll have more news quiz questions and, of course, much more to discuss in 2 weeks on Monday, June 2nd for our next evening program here at the club. And thank you to our panel, Bill Whalen, Dr. Larry Gersten, and Carla Marinucci. Thanks to all of you and everyone listening and watching on TV.
Thank you.
Have a great week.